Good evening, everybody. My name is Sandy Beach, and I'm an alcoholic. How you doing? Maybe I could start out with a public service announcement that I want to get out of the way. I was looking over the crowd, and there has to be 500 people, 400, 500, something like that, and there's a lot of older people here tonight. And I'm looking for a guy, and I met a couple of ex-military people here before dinner, who, the last time I saw him, and maybe you're here tonight, and I'll help identify you, and then maybe we could get together. But in 1964, you and I were both locked up in the nut ward of the Bethesda Naval Hospital in Bethesda, Maryland. I was in there for alcoholism, and I don't know what you were in there for, but you were a commander in the Navy in 1964, whoever you are, and you came into my room on the day before we had the grand prize for the best ashtray in clay class. And took your big cigar, put it out in my ashtray, and making it look like an accident, broke it. And everyone else there agreed that my ashtray would have won. And I figured a guy who would do that might end up in Alcoholics Anonymous. And after all these years, you might be approaching the ninth step. Now, I've forgotten about the whole incident. But just in the interest of helping your program, I'll be here after the meeting. I was in the nut ward in 1964 for 6 months. I was on active duty in the Marine Corps. I hadn't really chosen that as a duty station. And it was back before we had any alcohol programs in the military, and they put us in the mental ward. And about every couple of weeks, we'd have very intense group therapy. And they would gather us all around, and they would talk about schizophrenia, they'd talk about manic depressive, they'd talk about suicide. And when they ran out of things to talk about, the psychiatrist would say, "What about these drunks?" And there were two of us in there that were in there for being drunk. And they would start around these people, and when you hear their answer, you'll know why they were locked up in there. "So what do you think these alcoholics ought to do?" And to a man, they said, "You guys ought to stop drinking." And the next time I heard that was in Alcoholics Anonymous. It was suggested that I stop drinking. And I'm the type of alcoholic who, when we first came around, and back when I was drinking, I didn't equate stopping drinking with having to do with anything. When someone said, "The first drink gets you drunk," I just was at a loss to understand why they were saying that to me. I had this tremendous denial that goes on in alcoholism. And so when I heard that up there, I just said, like so many of us, "You don't understand. It wasn't my alcoholism that caused the problem. It was them." It was those people out there to get you and screw up your plans and cause all these events in your lives so that all of a sudden you're walking down the street, behaving yourself, minding your own business, and all of a sudden you're taken drunk. You remember how that would happen? You just... And I'd come dragging home, and I'd get the usual questions, what happened to you? And I'd go, I don't know, I was just walking down the street, and here I am. And so I just saw trouble as something that suddenly appeared, and I left out that middle part, which was drinking, that was what I was taught here, that I had something to say about it. I just thought I had to control events around me. That was my perception of the world prior to the lessons that I've learned here in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I did come into AA on Pearl Harbor Day in 1964. Very appropriate day for... My sponsor's anniversary is Hiroshima Day, so I don't know what... had something to do with getting bombed or getting even or... something like that. But anyway, as my friend Ed Chandler says, I didn't plan on hanging around here this long. Like so many of us, I was going to hang around long enough to get them off my back and then move on to resuming control of my life. And I'm very fortunate that I got a hold of a big sponsor I was in the Marine Corps at that time, and this guy was a giant of a man, and when I made this inadvertent call to intergroup, he came to my house and banged on the door. And when I went there, to this day, I still swear he filled the whole door frame, and he had a very basic AA message. He said, "Hi, my name is Bill. This is a 12-step call. I talk, you listen." And there, boom. And I started in with a routine about, well, could you leave some literature? That was a... And his response to could I leave some literature was, get in the car. We're going to a meeting. And I'm going, well, I got this and I got that. And all I heard was, get in the car. And so that, having no way to get away from a guy that big, is how I got to my first AA meeting in Manassas, Virginia on Pearl Harbor Day in 1964. And I haven't been drunk since that night, and I owe it all to not drinking. That's the key. If there's anybody new here, that's how you don't get drunk. You don't drink. And that keeps you alive long enough to find out how to get happy with not drinking, which is what the miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous is. And I think in my first month in AA, they laid that heavy one on me. They said, if you're in AA and you're not happy, you're doing it wrong. And I went, oh. Because I had a lot of things that had to be straightened out before I was going to get happy. And I think about that now, and I couldn't agree with a premise any more than I agree with that one. Because the power that we have in this program is available to change our perspective, to change our attitude on life, once we're willing and learn how to do it. And if you're new and you're saying, well, if this guy was in my shoes, he wouldn't be happy, I still maintain that that's a true statement. It's just as true as the premise was that if you drink enough, you can get happy. You remember that premise? You walked in there and you don't even have enough money to pay the rent. You got about half of the rent money. Standing at the bar with all the troubles of the world. You have four drinks. All of a sudden, you're a philosopher. With the one day at a time program. You remember that back then? Get half a load on. You got this money you're supposed to take home to the family, and you go, well, eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow we may die. You remember that? That was the drinkers one day at a time. And soon we were using the second half of the rent money to set up the bar, because we suddenly had no problems. So we already concede the fact that alcohol had the power to change our perception of reality. It had the power to do all these things that I had great faith in. And so does AA. And so does our higher power, which I think is what that statement has to do with. That if you're in AA and you're not reasonably happy, you're just not doing it right. Go back and work harder at it. Go back and try another angle, because it's here. And that's the good news. That's not a bad news thing. That's a wonderful bit of news, is that we are given the opportunity in here to learn how to change from the inside out so that we can adapt to reality as it hits us a day at a time and have a hell of a lot of fun doing it. And if it isn't fun, it's hard to stay sober. That's why it's so difficult for alcoholics to stay sober on our own through willpower. You know, some people have a lot of willpower, a lot more than I do. When I talk about staying sober on willpower, I'm talking about, in my personal record was like 8 hours. That was trying as hard as I could, you know, just no drinking today, no drinking today, no drinking today. Too late, there it is, I've already had it. But there are people who have stayed sober through their own willpower for great long periods of time. The only problem is that's all you can do. It takes all of our energy to not drink on our own. If someone asked you to chew gum and stay sober, that's too much. And you get through the end of the day, you're exhausted. And people say, let's go to a movie. How am I going to go to a movie? I've been staying sober all day. I don't have any. I got to go to bed. So we read in our AA literature, Bill writes so often, this program makes us efficient. Efficient. We're no longer using energy to do stupid things like that. We turn problems over and go about doing the things that are in line for us to do. I'm thinking up all kinds of... Then there was a time I was in Mexico. Got arrested in Tijuana. How many people got arrested in Tijuana? There has to be a few. Yeah, all right. Bad place. There are people down there that haven't been back ever. In talking about AA being a spiritual program, I thought of something. I'm going to tell you what I think. I was talking to Jim about this earlier today. But it does help me to communicate to you how I felt about alcohol and what I think alcoholism is as far as my own view of it. And this is my analysis of how we're born, how the whole ball game works. This is what life is, my own viewpoint. Nothing to do with AA. But I really feel that it works something like this, that there is a higher power. And when it's our turn to come into existence, this higher power gets together with us and says, I'm going to send you out there, and your job is to find me. And I'm going to tell you all about it. I'm everywhere. Everywhere you look, you can find me. And I'm with you. I'm part of you. You're an extension of me. You're part of this universe. And I'm going to put a longing inside of you, because when I stop talking, that's all you're going to remember. You're not going to remember one word I said. The only thing you're going to hit that street with is a longing. And I hit the street with the longing, just like everybody else has this longing. And you know what life consists of? An endless series of incorrect diagnoses of that longing. That's what life is. Most of the time, the longing feels like you need a $2,000 loan. That is the most common thought in the first 2 or 3 months in AA that I can imagine. The speaker's up there going, "The Serenity Prayer will make you so happy." And you're sitting there going, "So would a $2,000 loan." But at any rate, you know, I think, in the room what I'm talking about when I say the longing. It's that something inside of us that, in spite of all everything that's going on around us, says something just isn't right yet. You can call it the conscience, you can call it your soul, I call it the longing. It is that something that keeps human beings searching and looking and a feeling that you're not at peace with something. And we go off in a million directions trying to find the answer to this. And most human beings find it through a process that's quite foreign to most of us, called growing up. This is the most normal process, and human beings grow up mentally, physically, and spiritually. And as they reach a certain perspective, they start feeling that they're on this track of getting closer to whatever created them, whatever their concept of a higher power is, and that longing starts to disappear and gets replaced with a product known as joy. And we talk about that in AA, the wonderful joy of living. And for one way of looking at it is, it's the great joy of finally finding what was missing that we had so often misdiagnosed. Now, since alcoholics don't grow up, what in the world do they do? Well, for this alcoholic, I was 19 years old and had a chronic problem of whatever this longing was of being nobody and having the feeling, and even though I had high grades and I'm enrolled at Yale and I'm supposed to be doing this and that, when I went back to my little bed at night and sat down, this little voice just went, "You're nobody." You know what I mean? That was what was coming up from inside of me. I just didn't know how to relate to other people. I felt inadequate. I had the typical teenager feelings of not understanding what the heck was going on. You know that basic feeling as you go walking through the roads of life and you look around, everybody else seems to know what's going on, and you go, "How the hell do they know what's going on? I don't know what's going on around here. None of it makes any sense to me. I don't know where I'm going." And it's funny, we're given little things. I sometimes think about life as a journey that you... Wow! That's amazing. I sometimes think about life as a journey, and that navigating through it is the challenge, to try and find some direction or some way of getting your bearings. And I don't ever recall attending, prior to getting into Alcoholics Anonymous, the basic class, you know, Life 101, where they just come up here and they go, "Hey, let me tell you." And there was just, everybody had their own ideas. And a lot of the real clues that I picked up were written on bathroom walls. And be sitting in there, and former navigators had left little hints there, and I'd go, God, sounds highly unlikely to me, but I don't know why a guy would write it here if it isn't true. I guess, and when you're self-centered and prideful, you don't ask anybody about those things. You just handle it alone, and I'll figure that out eventually. So I had a lot of misinformation, a lot of trial and error starts, and nothing was really working. Nothing held it all together. I had been taught about faith. I had been taught certain things, but none of them seemed to work. They didn't seem to have any practical application. And so, like a typical teenager, things were just confusing as hell. But somehow you're chugging along, surviving. And, you know, I think back on navigating and faith, and I recall joining the Boy Scouts, and I remember the scoutmaster got up and he said, today we're going to teach you about the compass. Good. Then he had a little compass there, and he said, if you have one of these things, you can be in the woods, can't find your way, you don't know where you are. You haven't got the slightest idea where you are. You get this thing here, you can find your way out of the woods in Russia. I'm going, God, it's amazing. So let me show you how this works. So he opened that thing up, and he started out with this incredible story. He said, you know, there's a big rock up at the North Pole. I'm going, right, big rock, North Pole. And this needle always points at it. You know, I don't ever remember sitting there going, let's go up and check the rock out first. I just went, boy, that's a great deal. Here's this little thing, got a needle in it, rock up in the North Pole, you're lost in the woods, you're going to die, you just take this thing out. So the guy taught me a lesson. I had absolute faith in it. Come into Alcoholics Anonymous. My sponsor says, say the serenity prayer a couple times. I'm going, come on, I'm not going to say anything like that. You know, some things you take on faith, other things you just totally doubt. And they're both equally astounding. I mean, why in the world would I have any faith in the serenity prayer if I didn't have faith in the compass? They both have required great leaps of faith, and I'm willing to put my life on the line with this story that this guy told us when I was 12 years old, and I come in here, and the first time I heard about a spiritual program or prayer or any of those things, my brain is going a mile a minute. That isn't going to work. That's the craziest thing I ever heard of. People walking around trying to get in touch with a higher power to get guidance on how to get through this mess. What I need is a small loan. That's what I need. I don't need this. So we reject some of the things that we have seen analogies to in our lives. You know what I'm saying? We reject, Bill writes about prayer in the 12 and 12. We reject prayer as a scientist would reject performing a certain experiment lest it prove his pet theory wrong. You know what I mean? Like, gee, what if prayer does work? I'm going to have to reorganize my entire brain. All of these things I've been saying won't be true. Imagine how the map makers of the world felt when Columbus came back. I'm sure they didn't want to hear his story. Every map in their shop was wrong. They had flat maps. Hey, flat, go off the edge here. And this guy comes back and says, they're round. This is round. You got to redo all those maps. It would be more convenient to get rid of Columbus. So we're not the only ones who engage in denial. Because it's not convenient to make all those changes. That's a lot of work. Change all the lines on the mountains and the rear, every single little thing. And that's the funny thing that we hear about AA, I heard a long time ago, and I really believe it. There's just two things. This is for anybody who's new. AA is quite a simple program. Two little things. Don't drink. Change everything there is about you. Those two little things. And for an alcoholic to change his or her mind, I don't know about you, but first time, you ever see when an alcoholic's going to change their mind? They almost want to call a press conference. Like everybody in. I just want you to watch me. I'm going to change my position. Because we think it's a big deal because it's the first time we've ever done it. Change our mind, admit we're wrong about something, and yet sobriety consists of an endless series of changing our mind, as Chuck Chamberlain used to talk about, uncover, discover, discard. And we uncover the things that are incorrect. Old ideas avail us nothing. Well, all this information that I had collected along the way in my frantic search to meet this longing, or whatever you want to call that, discomfort, uncomfort, I stumbled onto something one day. It was called drinking. And I was in a room with 30 or 40 people. I was very uncomfortable in this surrounding. Wasn't quite sure how to get into a conversation with any of them. And as I sized them up, they looked pretty hostile. They had that look in their eye like, who is that guy? Why is he in our room with the rest of us, you know, that belong there? And I'm looking this over, and drinks were being passed around. And I'm 19. I haven't had a drink yet. And I remember my roommates were telling me, you ought to drink. Makes you feel good. It's a lot of fun. Hey, well, how could you be not drinking? And so that night, the discomfort was great enough that I took a drink. It was just a very deliberate thing. That's the end of that. I'm going to go on this new adventure. I'm going to feel good. And I remember drinking the drink, and nothing happened. And I had the feeling that it didn't work. Something wrong with the whiskey, and got another one. Because where was this great action that was going to happen? Where's all these things that are going to happen? This marvelousness. Drank another one. I don't remember. Nothing happened. I was sitting there trying to figure out when this whiskey was going to work on make me feel better when I looked up, and much to my amazement, they had taken those 40 hostile people out of the room and replaced them with 40 of the nicest folks I have ever seen. Everybody in the room was smiling at me and signaling, please join our group. And I remember just looking around going, now this is more like it. This is the way I like the world, like this. I said, you all have to wait over there. I'm going to start with this crowd, tell them a couple jokes, and then I'll be there, and then I'll be there. And I'd only been drinking about 8 or 9 minutes. And I intuitively knew how to handle situations that used to baffle me. Now, I've talked to some of my roommates since then. One of them's a big businessman down in Dallas. He's not an alcoholic. He liked to drink, and we partied and so on down. And he's fascinated with AA and has come to a few AA meetings when I've had the chance to speak down in Texas. And he and I talk about drinking, and I go, Roy, tell me about drinking in your life. What does drinking mean to you? And he will say, drinking? God, it's great. It's a wonderful way to unwind at the end of a busy day. It's an incredible way to meet people and have sort of a party and just have a little more fun than you would have had without it. It's just a nice addition to a meal to have some wine. But he never said, it's the secret of life. But that's what I would have said. So alcohol did something for me that it didn't do for him. It fixed everything at once. It put all of it together. It suddenly, I was at harmony with my environment. I was like a battery. You know how you buy a battery for your car and there's no water in it yet? You're supposed to take it home and add the water, and then the cells activate and you can start the car and all that. You got a brand new battery. I mean, this is brand new. This thing has never been used, and it won't start your car till it has a drink. And I was that kind of a thing. Everything was ready to function, but it wasn't connected right until you poured the alcohol in. And then when it got in there, systems fired off. Then I could see things. I looked down and said, there's a, oh, yes. And I saw the world clearly. I saw it in a much different perspective. It went away all, and then I understood all of the things I had been taught in church. I understood it's better to give than receive. I felt generous. I would always give money away. I mean, it was just amazing. It was all out of whack. It was the wrong higher power, but it was functioning in an incredible similarity to the higher power that I found here. It was functioning very similar to that. It fixed that me in a very... It's funny we use that word, fix. You know what I mean? It fixed me. You go out and get a fix. And that's a wonderful word for it, because that's what I felt like. I was broken. I was broken and I was lost. And what alcohol did, it gave me guidance. I just had the easiest time navigating around. Now, this is when the first few drinks went in. The problem was I didn't get it down right. I don't know how many people out here knew you had the answer. You just had to tinker with it a little bit. And I mean, we knew this was it. I mean, when I drank socially, like I say, 8 or 9 minutes and then crossed the line. Into alcoholism and stayed there until, so I was a primary alcoholic as opposed to this crowd that gets up here with this preposterous story that they drank successfully for 21 years and then their filter broke and the world went to hell in a handbasket. I know there's a lot of you in AA that are with those stories, but I don't understand that at all. I just drank and went out of control that night. Threw up all over the place and finally got out of there 15 years later and got into AA. So that was, never did I have control over alcohol, but it felt like I did. I guess what I'm trying to say is, early on, just that first night, I knew I was going to be drinking for the rest of my life. Drinking went from an unknown to the top thing in my life. In the first night, it went right by everything else. All the other things that I loved to do became second to drinking. Boy, that's an incredible... Something big must have happened inside. And it did. It just fixed a lot of things that needed fixing. And that's how I fixed them until I got to AA. And then you took it away. And when you take away... That, from me, you took away my whole act. That was my entire repertoire of behavior. And I started like from zero. I mean, that's what so many of us, when we say we're starting, whatever age you come into AA, that we're like 15-year-olds emotionally. And we are. We're just starting. But fortunately, we have a system, we have a program, and we have each other that can speed us through it a little faster so that we can catch up and sort of hang in there. And I got a good job now, and people come in, they want my opinion on things, and I write papers and they read them. And I see them over there, and they bring them back and go, "Thanks, Sandy, for looking at this." And when they leave, I just laugh like hell. I go, "This guy's listening to a graduate of the nut ward. I can't believe it." I just go, "Wow, that's amazing." So, well, you know, just a new perspective was given to me in here, and it is, and I realize they're listening to all of the help that I've gotten, and it just I'm sort of carry it on, and it's fun that way. Having turned my life over to alcohol, whether I knew it or not, I just had a typical alcoholic's journey. With all the going to jail, the happiness, the fun, the heartbreak, and the puking, and shaking, and lying, and remorse, and the standard boilerplate, ho-hum, drunkalogue that is so typical. Mine happened to be in the Marine Corps, which I joined drunk and left sober. How about that? And I ended up flying for them and was in some fighter squadrons and had a lot of fun. And it was very exciting, but it has nothing to do with alcoholism. That was my hobby. That was, being an alcoholic was my full-time job as it got near the end. Just remembering lies, leaving little notes to yourself. Okay, I told this guy I'm going over to the legal office, and what the hell did I tell him yesterday? And he said, "How did that go yesterday?" I go, "How did what go?" And he says, "Whatever you told me you were going to be doing." And I wouldn't remember. You remember how hard it was to keep track of lies and keep track of just what was going on? I can remember terrible, terrible memories of President Kennedy's after he was assassinated. It was just about the last year of my drinking, and I had become a daily drinker then. I had had so many problems flying, I almost ejected one time due to having withdrawal symptoms. I thought I was going to pass out in a jet, and I remember flying around with one hand on the ejection. This was my solution. You know, alcoholics have to come up with the bizarrest solutions to... I imagine there probably wasn't another pilot flying over Cherry Point, North Carolina that afternoon who was wrestling with the problem of, if I pass out, I'll have my hand on the ejection seat, my head will probably fall forward as I go out, and that'll eject me out, and the parachute will open by itself, and I will save myself. Who says I have a problem? Anybody who can think through things like that, obviously. It's when you get stymied with problems like that that you have a problem. At any rate, I had gotten grounded from flying because of these shakes and blackouts and sweating and all of these things, and was retrained in the Marine Corps' infinite wisdom as an air traffic controller. And so after 12 years of flying, I got in such bad shape they didn't want me in airplanes. Now I was bringing planes in bad weather when they couldn't see the runway, and so everybody had a problem. Fortunately, no one, there's no bad news stories or anything like that. But anyway, this is where I was on that particular year, and I had started daily drinking now that I wasn't flying, and that just got totally out of control, and I was on the home stretch. And I remember going to the ceremony in the hangar. And it was, and I liked President Kennedy a lot. This was a big thing to me. I really wanted to be there, and I wanted to be responsible, and I wanted to try and show up, you know, and be part of this thing. But I knew I couldn't do it without another 3 or 4 ounces of vodka because it was liable to last 3 or 4 hours. This thing was going to go on and on and on. So I was on my bicycle riding over to the Quonset hut to get the proper refill when the colonel came by in a Jeep, and he said, put your bike on here, I'll drive in. I said, no, that's all right, colonel, I don't need it. I got the little thing. Put your bike on here. No, that's all right, colonel, I don't need it. Put your bike on here. And I ended up in that hangar unarmed. And that thing started unfolding, and I remember standing at attention there, and the shake started in the legs, and it was cold as hell, and I was soaking through my uniform from sweating as this typical day wore on. In those latter stages of alcoholism, you just find yourself in these incredibly awful situations that, you know, really are so routine. You just stand. All I had to do was stand still. That was my entire function. If you could just stand still there, that's all you had to do. And I'm going, I'm going to fall off the hangar floor. I could feel the thing turning. And it's funny now, but it was just I felt like screaming then. I just wanted to cry and go out there. So I'm just saturated through my uniform, and the shakes have started, and my legs are just quivering, and I'm just standing there, and they're getting near the end, and they're playing the Star Spangled Banners coming up. And I knew that I had two awful choices. We're always confronted as practicing alcoholics with two awful choices. There's never a third one. And one of them was to try and salute with a hand that was just shaking just all over, which would cause everyone around me to go, what are you doing? What's the matter with everyone? You know, that whole thing. Or don't salute and be the only one in the hangar not saluting and cause the same thing. And I chose not to salute. In other words, in my judgment, that was less awful. They were both awful. And I remember afterwards talking to people to go, what's the matter with you? Jesus, don't you like President Kennedy? I mean, it was just one of those things, and there was no answer. The answer was, get drunk and forget about it. Just black out and go pass out. And that's how I would deal with days that were filled with these types of dilemmas that have no answer. There is no answer to that problem on your own. There's no way out of that situation. And there's just a whole bunch of those in the last year where they would just be checking into a hotel in Taiwan, going over an airspace conference, and I couldn't sign the register, and the ambassador's over there, and he's going, what's the matter with that guy? He can't sign the register, you know, and they're going, he's going to negotiate the airspace tomorrow of the... We were deploying an air wing or an air group over to Taiwan. I mean, you know, and it was just those kinds of things. Well, anyway, I feel extremely grateful as I sit here tonight or stand here tonight and think back on how many days were just filled with those kinds of things. Looks from your children that I can still see, where they just look at you either with pity or with fear or with great disappointment, and then they'd say something like, oh, that's all right, Dad, you can come to my birthday next year. And then you go, those hurt for a long time, you know, and you just get hit with those. And you know, I think the hardest part about being an alcoholic is we live just the opposite of the way we really wanted to live. That's what was so painful. And since we couldn't change the way we were living, we were trying to change the way we felt about the way we were living. I was trying to get unguilty about it. Oh, big deal, missed the birthday, ha, 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 ha. And then later that night, I'm going, oh, I missed it, and I'd be crying, I'd be so terrible. So my solution, this is the insanity of alcoholism, I was trying to kill the very good in me so it wouldn't be in conflict with the awful way I was living. That was how I was attempting to solve life's problems. if I could just kill my soul, there wouldn't be any conflict left. I could then go out and do all these awful things, and they wouldn't hurt me anymore. That's being powerless, because I didn't have the choice to change the way I was living. So, near the end, it isn't surprising that a whole bunch of people in this room and in rooms all over the country, if we weren't thinking about committing suicide, we were at least saying, if I die during the night, I'm not going to complain. You know, it was just... And then the great gift and comes to us in so many different ways. Mine came in the form of a convulsion. That's how I got in the nut ward, and that started the whole chain of events, the DTs and the convulsions and all those things. Funny about sobriety and alcoholism, we have a guy, Buck Doyle, Charlie knows him back in Washington, he says, everything's backwards with alcoholics. Everything's backwards. A practicing alcoholic, if he gets a promotion, we say, that's too bad. Because now we keep on drinking. If he gets fired, we go, that's good. He may get into AA now. Paradox. I had that convulsion, and I would have officially categorized it as a terrible event in my life. And I look back on it now, and that's what took me out of circulation, took me out of that rat race, and put me in here. That's how I got here. There aren't too many of us who were sitting around our living room and said, oh my. My drinking appears to be worsening. I think I'll just run over to AA tonight and catch this thing before it gets me into any trouble. There aren't too many of those. The more normal thing is an event occurs. A doctor calls you and says, if I was you, I wouldn't buy any long playing records. And he explains advanced liver damage. Or your boss calls you and says, hey, I'd like you to meet your replacement. And these events occur, and mine was a convulsion, and boom! And all of a sudden, we're in a whole new environment. We don't know how we got here, we don't know what's going on. And we're told not to drink anymore. And so we're left with raw pain. I'll tell you, that's hard staying sober that first couple months. That's just grin and bear it. And it's just like, what are these people talking about? I mean, I can tell myself at the end of a week, it ain't working. You know that? And we project ahead and we go, 50 more years of weeks like this? I can't believe that guy. I mean, I hear people that have 10 years, I go, how do they stand it? How could they last this long? We have no way of knowing that it's going to change. We're our own reference point, and it just looks awful, and it hurts, and it's so... And they're telling us these stupid things that we hear in here. And I guess in... I'm getting here. I better quit here. As we get into AA, this is how I think I'd like to wrap it up, is to say, I was on the right track when I knew there was an answer to this problem of the longing and the trying to get a handle on life and all that, and that you would have to find this answer and stick with it. And I had chosen vodka. And I stuck with it. And I had faith. And I really did. And us alcoholics, we stuck with that. We knew this was it. We were totally... You talk about turning your life over and making a decision. And even after we stopped drinking, how many of us with 6 months sobriety still had a secret $50 bill hidden in our wallet just in case this was a bunch of crap, you know? And a guy has to protect himself. And What if the world became too much for me again? I gotta be able to at least have a case. And as I leave here, I mean, it was hard to let go absolutely, but there comes a day, there comes a time, one way or another, when we take this great gamble and try this spiritual program. Try the idea of letting go and seeing if there is such a thing as a higher power. I didn't know what there is. And, you know, Alcoholics Anonymous doesn't have a higher power. We don't teach anybody about a higher power. What Alcoholics Anonymous teaches is the need for a higher power. It has a basic premise. If there isn't a higher power, you're in trouble. You have a serious condition. You are very similar. If you're new and you're just getting sober, let me describe where you are right now. You're like a guy who jumped out of a plane and forgot his chute. And it's about 8 feet from the cement. That's right where you are now. And a big hand called Alcoholics Anonymous reached out and just grabbed you and is saying to you as you get to the first and second steps, "Excuse me, sir. We're conducting a survey. Do you believe in God?" And what we're trying to communicate to you, if you are new, is under those conditions you won't look bad changing your mind. Even your worst enemy isn't going to go, "Ha ha, you're changing your mind." And that's what it's all about. I remember when I got my first big book, my sponsor said to me, "Read this book and realize this is your whole life and everything you need to know is in this book." You know, all sponsors say that. And I knew he'd be checking on me to see if I read the book, so I took it home and I did what I found some others have done. I took the pages and I folded them and pushed them and I got one of those yellow markers and I underlined. I wrote "wow" over here. And then to really throw him off the track, I got a coffee cup, and then I, you know, hey, he was up late with his coffee cup reading the big book. There's the stuff. And I put the damn thing on a shelf and hoped he never asked me about it, but I was ready if he ever was over my house and said, "You reading that big?" "Yeah, I'm reading that big book. I got that book." And while I was reading it, I noticed a chapter in there to the Gnostic. I didn't read it. I noticed it. And without reading it, I knew what was in that chapter, and it made me feel real good. This was the chapter for those of us who don't want to do the steps. This is how to stay sober and be an agnostic. It's in that chapter. Well, later on, there came a chance when I read the chapter and found out I was wrong. And if you're new, I'll tell you what's in that chapter, save you reading it. Chapter of the Agnostic says, "Become a former agnostic." That's what the chapter says. And so AA it's a very practical program, and it makes certain suggestions. And those suggestions ask you to perform a spiritual experiment. They set up a set of principles that have universally worked for human beings, and we've just collected them. Bill got them from religions, philosophies, and the early experience of Alcoholics Anonymous itself. It's a game plan for living, and it starts out with the premise that there's a higher power, just like there's a big rock at the North Pole. It just starts out with that. It just says there is such a thing. And if you will get in touch with that, and if you will follow these steps, that longing will go away. Now, the question is, what if you do it and the longing goes away? That's going to prove in your own case something incredibly wonderful to you. It'll be the single greatest gift you will ever get in your lifetime. I cannot think of anything bigger that has been given to me than the directions to unlock that marvelous thing called peace of mind, joy of living, and being part of something. This is a fun program. It's a deadly serious program. And we do it together. But underlying it all, and I know it in my own life, is a loving God. I don't know who that God is. I can't figure it out. I just know that when I conducted the experiment and continue that experiment on a daily basis, He's always there. And those things are fixed that never were fixed before. And if you're new, you are in for an incredible journey. You're going to learn something about yourself you never dared to dream. You are one of the most incredibly wonderful people in the world. You are, as Chuck Chamberlain said, in the final analysis, when you cut away everything, a child of God. And welcome. Thank you very much.